This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
This is from the record of Master Dongshan. When Dongshan first set out on a pilgrimage, he met a woman carrying water. He asked for some water to drink. The woman said, "I'll give you a drink, but I have a question I must first ask you. Tell me, how dirty is this water?" Dongshan said, "The water is not dirty at all." And the woman replied, "Go away. Don't contaminate my water buckets." So I've been thinking about this Taisho and how it seems very different because I'm speaking to you here in the Zendo and we have been sharing our lives together, practicing together all week, and I'm also sharing this with the larger Sangha who is all over the place. And what your days and week has been like and what your circumstances are. And then I realized, well, that's actually always true. It's not that different in a certain sense, except that the time is different. Dongshan was a very important teacher in our lineage, helped to establish what we call the Soto School, Japanese pronunciation, 9th century teacher. When he was young, he was studying and came across the Heart Sutra, the passage, "No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind." And he had a teacher that was not in the Zen tradition, and he went to ask him and said, "I don't understand this. I have eyes, I have ears. Why does the Heart Sutra say no eyes, no ear, no tongue?" And his teacher said, "I cannot teach you this," and sent him to another master within the Zen lineage. He was ordained at 21, and then he went out traveling on a pilgrimage to visit different teachers. And so this dialogue takes place at the early part of that pilgrimage when he was quite young. He met a clear-eyed woman on the path. Each day we chant all the women whose names have been forgotten or left unsung. And so this woman has no name, but has an important role, not just for Dongshan, but she has her own life. She has her own encounters with people. This is just one. And so if we forget such people, such women, then we can't know and appreciate all that they did in their lives, all of their struggles and their accomplishments, all those people that they taught and served and brought to liberation, all the ways they benefited the world. We can't, if we forget, we ignore how their names came to be forgotten and unsung by those who have told the stories and written the histories that did not include their names. And if we forget, we can't correct the harm done, which is an important part of our time. So Dongshan meets this clear-eyed woman and he just wants a drink of water. He's thirsty. He wants a respite from the heat, from his thirst. She wants to see his mind. She wants him to be free of all thirst. This much we can know from just a simple dialogue. "I will give you a drink, but there's something I have to ask you first. If you want to receive this, you have to give something." In practice, this is ceaselessly taking place, giving and receiving. Being made manifest, not just in ideas or the sense of it, but the real thing of it. We bow to each other. We wash each other's dishes. We clean each other's bathrooms. We prepare each other's meals. And we express our gratitude. We give our practice and we receive teachings. We give kindness and respect and receive kindness and respect in turn. And in this time, in the what we might call the time of virus, we give each other distance. And we receive, we hope, staying healthy. We give each other awareness and we receive less anxiety. We give each other attention and contact and we receive less isolation. It's a good example of how the clinging mind and the sense of separateness isn't really measured in feet. It's in our mind. So 6 feet apart is how we express our caring for each other. It's different. But in a way, it helps us to make very clear that our expression, our actual caring for each other, our actual compassion cannot be dependent upon space, because otherwise we're profoundly limited. When we talked yesterday with the residents about the 4 measurables in bringing people into our minds, seeing them in front of us, people that we may know but who are very far away, people we may not know. That's a way of making very clear that the actual distance between us and them is an actual distance, but it's not an obstacle in our expression of those 4 measurables. It's the Indra's web of interdependence, of intercausality, of mutual arising on vivid display. And we see that in this pandemic as both illness and medicine, that our profound web of interconnectedness is both the medicine, it's how it spreads, but it's exactly also the medicine, how it heals. Kind of interesting. And so she says, how dirty is the water? And the word she uses for dirty in Chinese means dust, taint, dirt. And we can think of that in a worldly sense, actual dust, sediment. We can think of it in a more spiritual sense, our delusion, our attachments. She just says, how dirty is the water? And in that, she leaves it completely open. You know, in early Buddhism, some hundreds of years, a few hundred years after the Buddha died, in the development of the Abhidharma, there was an understanding that since the time of the Buddha, that language was being used in different ways, had to be used in different ways. And so there's conventional language, which the Buddha acknowledged, that we have to use the language of everyday discourse, intercourse, so that we can communicate with each other. But there also has to be a language that is not conventional, that is ultimate, even though we're still using our same speech. Because we have to speak about things in an ultimate sense, so that they convey and point to and help bring us to awakening to that ultimate truth. And what's interesting about the koans and these very live dialogues is that the language can be functioning on both levels at the same time, but that the speaker doesn't point that out, doesn't clarify that, doesn't say, this is what I mean. She just says, how dirty is the water? Dongshan's answer, it's not dirty at all. So for the student who's not just reading this as an antidote, but actually wants to see the Dharma, wants to understand the Dharma, why is this in the record of Master Dongshan? Right? He had lots of casual conversations in his life. Why is this one preserved? And so then as the student, we have to enter into it, and it doesn't tell us, how am I to understand this? That's what we do. We, by examining it, come to our understanding. Is she speaking on an ordinary level? Is she speaking in an ultimate sense? Is he responding in one way or another? Are they separate? So she says, how dirty is the water? Is it clear? Is it cloudy? Is it pure? Is it impure? Is it the water we're actually discussing here? Dongshan says the water's not dirty at all. What does he mean? So the words convey mind. The words are mind. They are mind itself. They're expressing mind, our view, our understanding, our intention. They're also forming our view, our mind, our intention. How dirty is the water? Are you? Are you not? How deep is your delusion? How clear is your understanding? Is it? Isn't it? He says, the water's not dirty at all. And she says, go away. Don't contaminate my buckets. She startles us. Contaminate with what? If she says they're dirty, how could Dongshan contaminate them? If she's saying they're pure, then why does she send him away? And what does this have to do with today? What do we see when we see water? What do we see when we see someone who is sick? What do we hear when we hear the many voices talking? What do we not hear? On what level are people speaking? On what level are we hearing? For a person of the way, this has everything to do with everything. It's arising from mind, it's forming our mind. It's the seat and the seed and the bed of our thoughts, words, and actions. It's our karma. When the president refers to the coronavirus as the China virus, what do we see? What do we hear? What do we see into this person's mind? Two simple words. But what do we hear? What is actually being said? What is the intention? When our president says, I take no responsibility for this, what do we see in this mind? What do we see arising within us? When we free ourselves of right and wrong so that we can see in a different way, what is skillful here? What is unskillful? How do we respond to delusion? To delusion that has great consequence. Dogen says, the way of seeing mountains and rivers differs according to the type of being that sees them. A frightened being, an angry being, a defensive being, a compassionate being. So when we're seeing something or someone, we're seeing a being, but we're a being seen. And if we're a practitioner, we're a being being seen. To know our mind. He says, the waters which vary in accordance with the different types of beings don't depend on body or mind. They don't arise from karma. They're not dependent on the self or the other. So what is he saying? Understanding as he does, being enlightened as he is, was to the mutual arising, the codependence of everything. What does he mean? It's not dependent on body and mind, on karma, on self or other. He says it is dependent on water. Water is dependent on water. It is thus liberated. We should really reflect on that. And in that, water being dependent on water, water forsakes nothing. You know, I spoke about yesterday when we were meeting that what the Buddha realized, what we can realize, is that there is no conflict inherent in the world. Another way of saying that is there is nothing that is excluded. There's nothing that is forsaken in the world, in and of itself. We do that. Our mind does that. And so water, dependent on water, it means it forsakes nothing. It also accepts nothing. It denies or acknowledges nothing. Thus, it and all beings are liberated. He quotes the Buddha saying, all dharmas are ultimately liberated. They have no abode. We should realize that while they are liberated without any bonds, all dharmas abide in their own state. And this is where we have to really, as practitioners, we have to be diligent and work to understand how does this pertain, relevant? How is it relevant to today, to this time? Remembering that the Dharma is only concerned with this time. That time being whatever time we're in. That's all it's concerned about. And sometimes, particularly when these very deep, very profound, very direct teachings are being offered that are not explaining, they're not making that relationship for us. They're not saying, when I say this, this is how you can relate this to 2020 coronavirus. In that way, the teachings remain universal, right? They pertain to every time. Whereas in a sense, if they were related to one time, then we might think, oh, he's not talking to me. He's not talking to us. He's not talking about now. But it does make it more challenging to understand that all dharmas are abiding in their own state without any bondage. So around the world right now, there are people who are afraid of becoming sick. Some are in this room. There are people around the world who are sick. There are people who have died of this sickness. There are people who will become sick. There are people who will die. There are people who are recovering. There are people who won't get sick. Each abides within their own dharma state, completely fulfilling their virtue. In each of those possibilities, fulfilling their virtue, fulfilling their nature, their suchness. And this is not a matter of fate. It's not destiny. It's not something that's predetermined. It's not reward or punishment. It is the reality before us. You know, it would be very comforting to think that we live in a world where the universe itself is established within a kind of consciousness of justice. And that view exists in other traditions, but then what do you do in times of inequality, of injustice? How do you work that out? Buddhism doesn't see the world. The Buddha didn't realize that the world functions that way. We have to establish and work for justice, fairness, compassion, love, equality. not because the world is set up that way, but because when we do that, our experience of the world is vastly different. And so abiding in our own Dharma state in each and every moment is not an abstract idea. It is what makes liberation possible in every state. Because every state is just a momentary thing. It comes and it goes. It's already gone. 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 Because we don't see the swiftness with which it arises and passes. We see continuity. We impute a sense of permanence. And that gives us a false sense of stability, which makes it difficult to establish a good sense of stability, a realistic sense of stability, which then makes times that are unstable even more unstable. Some people are calm, some are anxious, some are being careful, some are not, some are caring, some are angry, some are taking responsibility, some are blaming. The governor, our governor of New York, gave a press conference recently, evidently he said this quite a few times, where he was talking to, I think, in particular the people of New York City, and he said, if you're upset, if you're angry at how things have been happening, at how we've done things, he said, don't get angry at the mayor. Don't get angry at this official, this official, this official. He said, get angry at me, him. He said, I'm where the buck stops. That's compassion. It's true. It's just, he understands his role. How do we understand this? The way is perfect like vast space with no excess and no lack. This is why the language of the Dharma has to function on an ultimate level. Because if we understand that teaching, that essential teaching, which I consider one of the most important lines in the faith mind and also one of the most dangerous. Because if we misunderstand it, if we understand it in a conventional sense, it seems to just say whatever is going on, no matter what degree of suffering or harm is being inflicted, it's perfect like vast space with no excess and no lack. It's okay, it doesn't matter, don't worry about it. If it's happening to you, it's your problem. That can't be true. And so it means, and when we encounter a teaching that can't be true in the way that we would ordinarily understand it because of the implications of that, it's not. It's not true in that way. It can't be true. So it means we have to examine it more deeply and understand how is that true? How is that what makes possible liberation? And then how do we manifest that? How is that already manifested? But how do we understand that and integrate that in a real moment of brokenness, of crisis? That is the ultimate challenge of the Buddha Dharma. I mean, that's what, you know, that's what is what makes, you know, our struggles on the meditation seat like not so difficult. But we can't stay there. When we're anxious, the state of our anxiety flows into our body, permeates our body, sensations. It arises as feelings, as emotions, into our mind, as thoughts. Sometimes coherent thoughts, sometimes just a jumble, a garble. They can consume us. We can be consumed within that state. That's samsara. And in that, we then spin, we spin, we spin, we spin. And it's exhausting, right? Talking yesterday, talking to a big chunk of Sangha last night via Zoom, a lot of people spoke about being exhausted. And I understand that. I've experienced that in my own way. So when our mind becomes unruly, unmoored from our mindfulness, right? It's exhausting because we're expending a huge amount of energy. We may not see it that way because we don't see ourselves as actively doing something as you might be when you're shoveling or when you're carrying something heavy. And it's the habitual nature of it that allows us to not notice that we are expending so much energy. It just seems to happen. And it can also be exhausting because we are holding all of those experiences, the feelings, emotions, the stress, the anxiety. And that's energy. So it's drawing from somewhere. It's not just, you know, energy is never created and destroyed. So it's not just coming into existence on its own. It's drawing from our being, our nutrients, our energy, our elements. And thus we feel that sense of, ah. And so then it's easy to want to just turn towards something that's just going to be like, you know, sort of affirm that. So I'm tired. It feels like doing anything would take a lot of energy. So let me do something that doesn't take any energy. Right? So I'll just zone out, or I'll binge watch, or I'll, you know, just... It's understandable. Right? It's understandable. All of us know that experience. And that's where we have to lean in. We have to really apply effort. And it's hard to do that when we're drawing upon, you know, a bank that seems rather low of resources. But it's there. And so we have to draw from that and sort of marshal, gather ourselves and shift that, turn that. That's why we practice. That's why we train. So that you actually can draw upon that. It's already there. And our day-to-day practice is what... It's not a thing, it's not a currency, it's not anything solid, but it is the continuity of consciousness. And when that continuum of consciousness is a continuum of distraction, of outflow, then we don't really have much to draw on, right? Because it's all going out. But when we have cultivated or are cultivating that, even when we find ourselves in a state of turbulence because of what's happening, that consciousness, that continuity is there. We can draw upon it. Even though in the moment it may seem difficult. And that's why it's so important at a time like this to practice more diligently. I came across a poem, a book of poetry by Theodore Retke that somebody gave me ages ago, and I opened it up and came to this poem which seemed to suit the day. And I can't read from the whole poem. It's too long. It's "What Can I Tell My Bones?" The first part, he says, "In a world always late afternoon, in the circular smells of a slow wind, I listen to the weeds' vesperal whine. Longing for absolutes that never come, and shapes make me afraid, the dance of natural objects in the mind, the immediate sheen, the reality of straw, the shadows crawling down a sunny wall. How little it takes to make us afraid when we lose our ground. We become very vulnerable. And vulnerable in a way that is not the vulnerability of courage and strength and confidence that comes from practice, but a different kind of fragility. Vulnerable to our habits and the habits of others. A bird sings, he says, out in solitariness, a thin, harsh song. The day dies in a child. How close we are to the sad animals. I need a pool. I need a puddle's calm. I need something. Even the calm of a puddle, I'll take it. Not much. It'll dry up in a moment. The Buddha wanted more. He had lots of those puddles. He wanted more. And he spent the rest of his life teaching because he wanted us to have more. This woman, clear-eyed woman, she wanted more for Dongshan. Dongshan wanted more for his students. That's what's been passed down. Wanting more than just the calm of a thin puddle. Master Tao Chuan once asked Dongshan, what is the essence of being free in this world? Dongshan said, Acharya, there's smoke rising under your feet. At that, Chuan experienced enlightenment and said he never wandered again. He never went looking again. Later, Master Yunchu said, we should be grateful to Dongshan, under whose feet smoke was also rising. We're like this. Smoke rising under our feet. You know, when we see ourselves in things as fixed, as separate, as distinct, things shift. They keep shifting. They get from going from small to smaller, from tight to tighter, from less to lesser, from imperfect to more imperfect. When we release our grip, the great way is perfect, like vast space. There's no excess and there's no lack. Beyond all measuring. And in accord with all measuring. Perfectly in accord with observing, with evaluating, with choosing, with making decisions, with being uncertain. And making a decision anyway. It's like Dada Roshi used to talk about in the very early years when it was just him and a handful of others. And he said, we're just going to do this like it's happening. We are going to do this and it is happening. And to do that, to make choices, to make decisions, and to commit to them knowing that we're doing that within uncertainty is an expression of wisdom. To do that and pretend that we know everything or to ignore what we don't know is very different. Retke said, it is difficult to say all things are well when the worst is about to arrive. It is fatal to woo yourself, however graceful the posture. Loved heart, what can I say? When I was a lark, I sang. When I was a worm, I devoured. The self says, I am. The heart says, I'm less. The spirit says, you're nothing. Mist alters the rocks. What can I tell my bones? My desires, a wind trapped in a cave. The spirit declares itself to these rocks. I am a small stone loose in the shale. Love is my wound. Is he speaking from the place of impoverishment, of insufficiency, of separation, of destitution? Or is he speaking from the place of perfect, like vast space? Is what's most important where he is speaking from? Or is what most important, how do I hear this? How do I use this? How to be perfect in our imperfection? How to be confident in a time of uncertainty? J. just have no abode. What is the essence of being free in this world? There is smoke rising under your feet. Be grateful because it's rising under every foot. That's why Dongshan spent the rest of his life teaching. The smoke rising under our feet is really the food and drink of the Bodhisattva path. It is what animates life. Sometimes it's the smoke from the fire that's cooking your meal. Sometimes it's the smoke from the fire that's burning down the house. I was reading this article, I think I mentioned it last week, from this professor of the history of, a professor who was a professor of the history of medicine, Professor Emeritus at Yale, Frank Snowden. And he said some interesting things, again, talking about pandemics, which is his field of study. He said, epidemic diseases are not random events that afflict societies capriciously and without warning. It's not something that's happening to us. It's not something that has a consciousness like an evil. A virus wants to live just like we want to live. Right? It's kind of crazy, right? All life wants to live. And yet sometimes something that wants to live has to consume life, as we all do, but consumes it in a way that destroys the very life that it needs to live. He says, on the contrary, every society produces its own specific vulnerabilities. To study them is to understand that society's structure is to study them is to understand that society's structure, its standard of living, and its political priorities. Everything we see is us. Everything we do is mind. And what we can speak of in terms of society, we can speak of in terms of person. He says, epidemics are a category of disease that seem to hold up the mirror to human beings as to who we really are. That is to say, they obviously have everything to do with our relationship to our mortality, to death, to our lives. He says, obviously. Is it obvious to everybody? They also reflect our relationships with the environment, the built environment that we create, and the natural environment that responds. They show the moral relationships that we have toward each other as people, and we're seeing that today. Again, it's you know, important to note that when somebody is studying in a totally different field with different instruments of observation and examination using different tools, who may know absolutely nothing about Buddhism. When they study and see into that reality, what they speak of should make sense to us as Buddhists. We should see the Dharma being expressed in what he's saying here. For practitioners, this is true all the time, not just during epidemics. Everything is always showing the moral relationship we have with ourselves and with each other. Everything is always holding up the mirror as to who we really are. I mean, that's what practice is, right? We enter into practice and realize, oh, everywhere I go, there's a mirror. And sometimes that's great news and sometimes it sucks. Right? We don't want to look in the mirror. We don't want to look in the mirror. And then we realize, oh, wait a minute, it didn't start here. That everything, everywhere we look, has to do with our relationship to our mortality, our death, and our lives. And for a practitioner, this is like, hallelujah. It means we don't have to wait. We don't have to depend on certain circumstances, on the right conditions, on being in a particular place. So for those who are practicing at home, this is the place. That is the place you have. That is the place that is holding up the mirror. That is the place where you see your relationship to death and mortality and life. Then he said, that's one of the great messages that the World Health Organization keeps saying. The main part of preparedness in facing these events is that we need, as human beings, to realize we are all in this together. That what affects one person anywhere affects everyone everywhere. That we are therefore inevitably part of a species, and I would say an omni-species, a pan-species, and that we need to think in that way rather than about divisions of race and ethnicity, economic status, and all the rest of it. He's a scientist. I don't know anything about him. I don't know what else, what other things he's bringing in and are influencing him. But in speaking as a scientist, he cannot separate morality. He cannot separate life and death because it's not. And so Yun Chu says, be grateful to Dongshan, under whose feet smoke is also rising. Under whose feet, our feet, smoke is arising. Dongshan said at the end of that dialogue, treading the darkling path is persevering in practice. The darkling path is the non-dual path. It's a term that had meaning in Taoism, but Buddhists took it on and gave it that meaning. Treading the non-dual path is persevering in practice. And perseverance can be very gentle. It can be very subtle. What makes it perseverance is its constancy. It is steadfast. It is constant. It is, in its root meaning, a keeping up, a going on. One awareness, one intention, one action. Retke says, the sun, and all we can become, and the time ripe for running to the moon. In the long fields I leave my father's eye and shake the secrets from my deepest bones. My spirit rises with the rising wind. I'm thick with leaves and tender as a dove. I take the liberties a short life permits. I seek my own meekness, soft, gentle. I recover my tenderness by long looking. By midnight, I love everything alive. Who took the darkness from the air? I'm wet with another life. Yea, I have gone and stayed. What came to me vaguely is now clear. As if released by a spirit or agency outside me, unprayed for and final. Yes, let's look long and love everything alive and see, is there anything not alive to love? And to know that this agency is not outside. It is not an agent. It is this moment, this moment, this moment, coming together, coming apart, coming together, coming apart. Which means that every moment, born again. We are not bound in any ultimate sense to a past or a present or a future. And so let us trust this Dharma and take refuge and be, you know, this is where we can really make our practice generous and understand, really examine and understand how when we turn to our mind training, that is something we can give to everybody, because there are many people everywhere who may be struggling right now because of a struggle with mind training or not training. And that's not a better or worse thing in terms of being a person or living a life or doing the best one can. But it is something we can be grateful for, that we have a mind training and can understand the vast implications of that and take refuge in that at a time in which that is so needed and such a good medicine.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.